Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are working on today, Tuesday, March 10, 2015. SPLM official says the government has not given up hope on the peace process.
Our commitment to peace, however, dear people of South Sudan, does not mean signing a bad peace agreement.
And Central Equatorial State official acknowledges the crime rate in Juba is unusual in recent months.
These organized crimes has connection with the foreigners. You know, we have a presence of many nationals in Juba.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Despite the failure of the two warring parties to reach a final peace agreement last week, South Sudan's ruling party, the SPLM, says it is still committed to a peace process that will end the current instability in the country. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Ann Ito, acting secretary general of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, or SPLM, says the party is committed to any peace initiatives that will end the current crisis in the country within reason.
I want to state that our commitment to peace, however, dear people of South Sudan, does not mean signing a bad peace agreement or an agreement that will jeopardize future stability of this country or put our country and people at a great risk.
Speaking to reporters today at SPLM headquarters, Ito says the SPLM wants South Sudanese to support all peace initiatives, including religious and traditional dialogues that focus on restoring stability in the country. President Salva Kiir, the head of the SPLM, and rebel leader Riek Machar were both roundly criticized for not putting the people of South Sudan first and failing to strike a deal by the IGAD-imposed deadline last week. Despite that failure, Ito says the government is making moves to restore stability. She cites Mr. Kiir's decree last month offering amnesty to all South Sudanese who took up arms against the government to return home.
Over 20 people since order was released by the President of the Republic have returned officially. But there are so many other people who may be returning to government-held areas that we have not received report on.
A leaked African Union report of inquiry blames the SPLM leadership for causing the instability that began in late 2013. It suggests ethnic troubles were brewing in South Sudan long before the outbreak of violence in December 2013. Ito blames the rebels for not reaching a deal last week in Addis Ababa. She says several proposals put forth by the rebels were unreasonable. For one, she says you cannot have two armies coexisting in South Sudan's transitional government. She also dismissed a rebel proposal for a 50-50 power-sharing split. Ito also criticized the UN Security Council vote to impose sanctions on individuals.
Even though they said it's going to be selective on leaders, but any kind of sanction would affect our people. I think at this point in time, it is more important to focus on finding peace rather than punishing people.
Spokespersons for the rebels have said they would support additional sanctions on individuals from the United Nations. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The spokesman for Central Equatorial State says the crime rate in and around Juba has spiked over the past year. Suba Samuel Manasi says South Sudan's ongoing conflict is to blame for rampant insecurity in the city and the suburbs of South Sudan's capital. Juba Town has been the scene of violent crimes in the past 1 year. Most foreign investors have been complaining about the lack of adequate security in South Sudan. South Sudan's entry into the East African community is pending, and the country's security situation could be a big determining factor on whether or not the regional trading bloc allows South Sudan to join its community. Many business owners from Kenya, Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Rwanda say they don't feel safe when conducting business in Juba. The Central Equatorial State Minister of Information, Suba Samuel Manasi, says the situation is getting out of control.
Juba these days, indeed, there are a lot of problems as far as security situation is concerned. This is not in the whole of Juba as a city, but in specific areas, particularly in areas where there is internal problem of transport and also a problem with the lighting and also a problem of presence of the police in the area.
This past year, South Sudan's police service introduced the emergency number 777 to help reduce the crime rate in and around Juba. But residents still complain that when they call, the emergency number police arrive late. Samuel insists police are responding to the emergency calls as soon as they can.
The police did their level best. They're able to institute some policies, beef up security around Juba, introduce 777, that is an emergency response for any crime activities. The citizen can be able to call them and they can respond immediately.
The government of South Sudan deployed soldiers around Juba town when violence broke out following a political disagreement within the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement in December 2013. Samuel says part of the problem is a large number of military personnel in Juba town giving criminals firearms.
With the breakdown of the law and order, met guns also to infiltrate into the hands of illegal persons. There were efforts to recollect guns from illegal hands in Juba. But now, with the war, most of these munitions also went back to the hands of the people, and probably this contributed to these serious cases of crimes.
Samuel blames criminals from neighboring countries for taking part in some of the worst armed robberies in Juba town's history. He says South Sudanese are also trading firearms to suspected foreign gangs.
These organized crimes has connection with the foreigners. You know, we have a presence of many nationals in Juba. And in most cases, the planning part of these missions are organized by foreigners. And then the Southerners provides the ammunitions or even they do the executions.
The minister says South Sudan's borders are poorly managed. Samuel says criminals are entering the country undetected. He says the best way to address the insecurity is to introduce strict immigration rules.
Our borders are porous. And two, we are Africans. You may have a Ugandan, a Nigerian, or a Kenyan in South Sudan, and you may not know that this person is a foreigner because he looks like any common other person. And thirdly, our immigration policies are not yet strengthened, and the capacity of our immigration is not yet up to date.
Thousands of nationals from Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda moved to South Sudan after the country gained independence in 2011. Many foreigners complain of harsh treatment by security personnel in South Sudan. Senior government officials have repeatedly warned security officials against mistreating visitors or foreign workers in South Sudan. If you look on Twitter, you will find at least 13 accounts with President Salva Kiir's name on them. And on Facebook, there is an account in the name of Salva Mayardit Kiir. The only problem with these accounts, none of them is actually associated with President of South Sudan. But as Michael Atit reports, President Kiir will have a social media presence soon.
Mr. Kiir's spokesman, Ateny Wek Ateny, says the President of South Sudan has never had a social media account in his life. He says the current Twitter and Facebook accounts that bear the name of Salva Kiir are all fake.
The Twitter account and the Facebook account, which has been going on for a number of years now, portraying the president as the owner of that account, is not true because it's a fake account. The president never had any Facebook account or Twitter account.
Ateny says the Facebook account was created in 2012 by an unknown person. He says his office is following the account closely to try to find out who set up the account and who is running it. He says whoever runs the account with Twitter handles @Salva_Kiir and @SalvaKiir1, just to name a couple of bogus accounts, are not really communicating with the people of South Sudan because most of South Sudanese don't use social media.
The average person of South Sudan doesn't even know, have the idea of the Twitter or Facebook. These are the sophisticated things that will take time before they come to South Sudan. So if the president have that such account, he will not even be getting to the people who elected him. The people who elected him 99.9% may not have the idea of what is Twitter is all about.
Attain says some of the social media accounts that use version of Mr. Kiir's name are dishonestly trying to misguide people into thinking President Kiir has bad intentions and does not want to restore peace in South Sudan. Attain says his office is in the process of designing official social media accounts for the president. They will launch it soon, he says.
We are planning to have Facebook and a Twitter account for the president, the official one, that will be actually managed by my office in conjunction with the IT department, and that is going to come in the due course. We will launch it.
Attain suggests that people who are following the bogus of Salva Kiir accounts on Twitter and whoever liked the president's alleged page on Facebook should unfollow him and unlike him. The real Salva Kiir will be available on social media soon, Attain says. He gave no indication as to what Mr. Kiir's Twitter handle will be. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Washington.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a new medical training project in and around Juba, thanks to the Japanese. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what can be done to reduce corruption in government?
Yeah, sometimes they have to do corruption because they delay in their getting their salaries. In order for them to stop, the government has to give their salary on time.
First of all, government officials should declare their assets before taking office. And secondly, government officials should be accountable to the society, which means they should give either a weekly, monthly, or yearly report. Doing this, they will reduce corruption because the people will know exactly what is going on.
If one government is fond of being corrupt, of course we wouldn't just tell them, you know, you're corrupt, get out. So the only thing we shall do first is to warn them, give them a standing warning. If they continue so, they will be taken to courts of law.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about a new health training program in South Sudan. In Juba, the Embassy of Japan today announced the launch of a new $350,000 project aimed at training midwives and nurses working in Juba and nearby towns, a project that is sorely needed in South Sudan. Waki Simon Wudu has this report for VOA from Juba.
The sound of enthusiastic applause from South Sudanese attending a grand signing ceremony at St. Mary's College for a project that could improve the lives of pregnant women and newborns in Juba in the coming years. The one-year project will be implemented by the Italian organization, the Volunteers Organization for International Cooperation, or OVCI, and it comes not a moment too soon for South Sudan. The United Nations Development Program says South Sudan has one of the worst maternal mortality rates in the world. More than 2,000 women die per every 100,000 live births. That means one in seven South Sudanese women will likely die from pregnancy-related causes in their lifetime. Another startling statistic, there is only one qualified midwife for every 30,000 women in the country. The $350,000 grant for the project was donated by the Japanese government as part of its foreign aid extension to South Sudan. Its aim: reduce critical health care shortages in South Sudan. Simon Servi is the technical coordinator for OVCI in South Sudan. He says the project will begin soon with the construction of a permanent training center. The building will host training facilities for professional nurses and midwives. Servi says project coordinators plan to train at least 200 health care workers during its year-long program.
The objective of the project is to improve the performances of the health staff already operating in the facilities of Juba, PHCU, PHCCs, and hospitals, in order to address the health needs of the vulnerable population in this area.
But Servi says project coordinators have a very specific target in mind:
improving the maternal health and contributing to reduce the child mortality rate in line with the Millennium Development Goal number 4 and 5.
Takase Akamatsu is the Japanese ambassador to South Sudan.
We are very glad to announce today that with the project we have just signed with the OVCI, we will be an extension of our existing cooperation by offering appropriate training facilities as well as providing intensive training opportunities for experienced nurses and midwives.
Unfortunately, today Akamatsu says only a quarter of the population of South Sudan has access to health care facilities. Akamatsu says the operating capacity of existing health facilities in South Sudan is poor at best. He describes what he learned while visiting a hospital in Juba last year.
I found that brand new medical equipments installed several years before were seemingly not used at all. I asked the manager the reason why these equipments were left unused. He told me that it was because their staff was not trained to make use of these medical equipments and expressed urgent needs in upgrading their capacities.
Dr. Felix Ladu, the Minister of Health for Central Equatorial State, says his government is on board with the new project and working with its organizers, but much more must be done to improve the state's health care services.
We have a lot of medical facilities in counties. Most of them are without manpower. No clinical officers, no laboratory technicians, no midwife.
Ladu says he is particularly concerned about South Sudan's maternal and newborn health. 2015 is a critical year for focusing on this topic as the United Nations Millennium Development Goals project deadline expires this year. Goals 4 and 5 challenge developing nations like South Sudan to make significant efforts to lower maternal and child rates. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Udu in Juba.
Continuing on the health beat, we take a closer look at malaria, a disease which affects tens of thousands of South Sudanese. Malaria is an entirely preventable and treatable mosquito-borne illness, according to the World Health Organization. Yet WHO statistics show the disease threatens up to 50% of the Earth's population. Malaria also kills more than 500,000 people every year. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that despite these grim statistics, progress is being made and lives are being saved.
The world is winning the war against malaria. A huge increase in funding over the past 10 years for control and treatment programs has cut deaths from malaria by nearly 50% worldwide and by even more in sub-Saharan Africa, according to the World Health Organization. Anti-malaria programs have saved an estimated 4 million lives, most of them babies and young children in Africa. The biggest boost came when then-President George W. Bush launched the President's Malaria Initiative. It provided millions of dollars for bed nets, mosquito spraying, and medicine. And it helped local health workers learn to diagnose and treat malaria patients. Dr. Fatoumata Nafo Traoré coordinates the international anti-malaria effort under the Roll Back Malaria Partnership. She says the U.S. contribution has helped developing countries strengthen their healthcare systems while providing money for drugs and rapid diagnostic tests.
In any single village, you can use the tests and know the result in 10, 15 minutes, be able to give treatment to really any person suffering from malaria.
President Obama has refunded the program for 6 more years. The goals are to cut the number of deaths by a third and to eradicate the disease by 2050. Dr. Nafo, as she is called, says it isn't enough.
Since 2000, the level of funding for malaria has increased tenfold, from $200 million to $2 billion. But still, we're short of 50% of the resources required for the global fight against malaria.
In addition, two things are happening that threaten the gains made so far. In Africa, mosquitoes are developing resistance to the most commonly used insecticides. Others are available, but they cost more. In Asia, the parasite may be developing resistance to artemisinin, the main anti-malarial drug. Artemisinin still works, but more doses are needed for a longer period of time before a person recovers. Researchers worry that this is the first step toward total drug resistance. Dr. William Moss from the Johns Hopkins Malaria Research Institute spoke to VOA by phone from Lubumbashi near the border between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia.
We need to intensify our efforts to control this artemisinin resistance in Southeast Asia.
Dr. Moss says drug resistance could eventually spread to Africa, where the majority of malaria cases occur. Just as travel between regions of West Africa helped the Ebola epidemic spread, Dr. Moss says the same can happen with drug-resistant malaria. He says malaria control has to be a regional effort.
And if it's not all done together, the success and gains in a particular country can be undermined by the importation of malaria from their neighbors.
Dr. Moss says further reducing deaths from malaria is an achievable goal, but it's going to be increasingly challenged by both insecticide resistance in Africa and drug resistance in Asia. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John, and nice to have you back. Witnesses report hearing a loud explosion today in the Nigerian city of Maiduguri, where bomb blasts killed more than 50 people on Saturday. A reporter for VOA's Hausa service says the explosion in Maiduguri occurred shortly after 4 p.m. local time and appeared to have hit a market area in the city. He said police were blocking reporters from getting to the scene. Four blasts struck Borno state capital on Saturday, some of them detonated by female suicide bombers, according to police. A suicide truck bomb and roadside explosives killed two people and wounded more than 40 today in Egypt's northern Sinai Peninsula. A man driving a stolen water tanker truck blew himself up at the gates of an Egyptian police camp in the northern Sinai town of El Arish, causing numerous injuries. The attack comes only days before a high-profile international investment conference takes place in the southern Sinai resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. And finally, the International Monetary Fund has ruled out resuming loans to Zimbabwe until the southern African country has retired its long-standing external debt of about $10 billion. Zimbabwe's government is seeking new loans to help bail out its depressed economy. After concluding a two-week review, Domenico Feniza, who headed the IMF delegation, said Zimbabwe is making progress toward re-engaging the international community, but added Zimbabwe remains in debt distress. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
We now turn to Nigeria, where Muslims who fled to Cameroon in order to escape Boko Haram say they are being shunned as suspected sympathizers of the insurgent group. And the suspicions are not only from Cameroonians, but Nigerian Christians who do not trust them and refuse to live with them in refugee camps. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
C'est l'événement le plus terrible que nul ne peut réfuter.
French-born Muslim Rashid Abu Hodeifa preaches peace and tolerance at the central mosque in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. Among those listening is Nigerian refugee Abdullahi Diallo, who says he fled his hometown of Dikwa to get away from Boko Haram, but has been persecuted in Cameroon by people who think he is a sympathizer of the Nigerian terrorist group. He says many people mistakenly think that Islam and Boko Haram are synonymous and do not trust Muslims. He says Boko Haram is not Islam. But that message is a hard sell in communities victimized by Boko Haram violence, kidnappings and raids that have spilled into Cameroon in the past few years, as the insurgents fight to set up a caliphate in northern Nigeria. Umaru Ngomna, the traditional ruler of Kemzego village on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, says he does not accept strangers who are Muslims because they have had a history of violence in Nigeria.
Quand vous dites que quelqu'un entre dans un village
He says he had to ask them to leave his village because he was informed that some Muslims in Nigeria burn mosques, churches and villages and even slaughter people. He says he is very skeptical of any Muslim visitor. Sociologist Manga Pegi says he feels threatened when he sees Nigerian Muslims.
I feel threatened because I see what is happening in neighboring Nigeria. I see the carnage that Boko Haram has been inflicting on innocent people in Nigeria and in Cameroon. And I see what the Islamist extremists are doing in other countries.
But it is not just Nigerian Muslims who are shunned. Nigerian Christians also face stigma and suspicion. Elias Yeager is among them.
They combine us, both Muslim and Christian. But sometimes we got problem because we call them Boko Haram sometimes. They will catch them and carry to the security here.
The growing stigmatization has prompted religious groups to step up their messages of tolerance. Christian Manupa is with the Catholic Church's Ecumenical Service for Peace. He says while people must be vigilant of security threats, they must also have compassion for the Nigerians who are in desperate circumstances.
It's recurrent. It is very, very deplorable. First of all, the refugees have lost all their livelihood. There's no other means of survival. They now are dependent on the goodwill of the host community, perhaps of the host government.
Sheikh Umaru Ibrahim, a Muslim spokesperson in Yaoundé, agrees. He tells VOA there is Christian-Muslim cooperation here to help overcome the stigma Nigerian Muslims face.
We have talked about something which is essential. We can do it. It is the interreligious dialogue. We are joining ourselves with Christians and praying together. We are doing our best, educating our children, our populations in churches, in mosques to live in peace.
But the problem can be complex in the face of tactics used by the insurgents. In February, Cameroon's military arrested groups of Boko Haram fighters who were disguised as refugees. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
That was our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Hasadama Ako by a South Sudanese musician who calls himself Irisaka Number One. Venus Mazu Kele Ayatana Siraba. Venus Mazu Kele Ayatana Sisala. Venus Mazu Kele Ayatana Sigeru. Venus Mazu Kele Ayatana Sisala. Listening to Isaka Number One with that beautiful song, Hasadama Ako. I'm John Tanza in Washington. It's good to be back with you. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.